Again, thank you very much to Kenneth Martinez. Next, I will be presenting you my research that I conducted at the University of Minnesota and has since expanded upon it. And this relates to the attitudes and beliefs about nano on campus environments, campus research laboratories. The primary research interest was we wanted to see what we were doing to protect the health and safety of researchers in campuses who work with novel technologies. And nanotechnology presented a wonderful opportunity to as an exemplar case of novel technologies. And we looked at the social and behavioral perspective rather than a technical assessment of exposure to nanotechnologies. We used a case study approach. And as I mentioned, the case study, the initial case study environment was a large research university in the Midwest. We used mixed methods for data collection. We interviewed experts. We observed laboratories, nano research laboratories, as well as we reviewed a large variety of institutional documents in terms of how they were planning on guaranteeing the safety of the researchers as well as the other workers in the laboratory environment. And the protocol was reviewed by the IRB, the Institutional Review Board. So in my talk, I'm going to discuss three aspects in terms of the current state of occupational and health and safety in nano research laboratories on a campus in a campus environment, the ideal state of OHS oversight, and maybe some thoughts on how we might begin to close the gap in terms of some of the research researcher safety gaps that we have identified on campus. In terms of our slate of experts in this study, as it happened in 2010, the state of Minnesota approached University of Minnesota and other institutions in the state to prepare a report on the state of affairs in terms of nanotechnology in the region. The university itself had identified its nanotechnology experts. These were faculty members as well as staff. And through our research, we also identified that the Institutional Review Board, for reasons that I will go into later, was also instrumental in understanding nanotechnology safety on campus. So we approached them as well for interviews. I'm going to, in terms of the current state of affairs in nanotechnology safety on campus, there were two findings that were rather interesting, we thought. One of them was that there is really not even agreement as to what to call nano on campus. When we interviewed individuals, and Dr. Ostrad had actually touched upon that too, people took issue if we said you're doing nano research. They said, no, I'm using nanoparticles, but I'm not doing nano research. Or, no, I just happen to have a catalog and I order nanoparticles from a company, but I'm not doing nano research. So as a compromise, we found that eventually we had to actually just say, you're working with nano and not say nanotechnology, nanoparticles, or nano research. So we thought this was an interesting finding. So there isn't even agreement on what to call this thing on a campus environment. In terms of some of our other findings, in the academic nano environment, there's a very highly diverse workforce. And the diversity comes in terms of age, experience with the task, their literacy, and also their attitudes. You have anywhere from a summer intern who's spending 2 months in the research laboratory all the way to a very experienced researcher who might have devoted their career to nanotechnology research. So in terms of their attitudes towards their safety, we saw a wide difference or a wide range. There is really no standard oversight of nanotechnology in the campus environment. Now, we mentioned IRB, IACUC, and IBC. Some of you, if you worked in the academic environment, are familiar with these acronyms. IRB deals with if a research study deals with human subjects. As you might guess, at this point, a lot of nanotechnology research does not have human subjects. So IRB, lo and behold, knows nothing about nano research on campus. IACUC deals with when the research deals with animal subjects. And at this point, because a lot of research is material science related, animals are not being exposed to this either. So again, the second significant way for a campus to find out nano IOCOQ doesn't get involved either. And IBC is bioagents, and we didn't find any kind of research that actually used bioagents and nano at the same time. So now, all of a sudden, you see that in the college environment or the university environment, the university no longer has access to even to find out which labs on campus are working with nano to begin with, which really hampers oversight efforts. And we also found out that the student workforce is particularly vulnerable. They're very low on training in terms of understanding and appreciating occupational hazards in the laboratory environment, and they're very low on the power hierarchy. Now, in our interviews with graduate students and undergraduate students, over and over the theme that came up was, I need to get done with my dissertation. I need to get done with my thesis. The implication being, I cannot be bothered with trying to understand the implication of for my health and well-being. These findings also, they're also very interesting findings about nano in the campus environment. In terms of what might be considered safe, here are some of the myths and perhaps facts that emerge in our research. One belief is that if a nanoparticle is in solution, regardless of the kind of solvent that's being used, the solution that's being used, it's considered safe. So the myth or the belief seems to be that if it's a dry prep, it may have some health hazards, but if it's in solution, it's good, it's good, it's safe. I don't have much to worry about. We also encountered something that is rather interesting, this thing called experimental dose. Over and over, we heard researchers and graduate students tell us that they didn't think they were exposed to occupational hazards because their amount of exposure was in experimental doses. So when we push them to tell us what they mean by an experimental dose or to put a unit on it or a measurement on it, there really wasn't an exact answer. So again, this emerges as, I believe, a myth that in the research laboratory, the experimental dose somehow makes nano exposures not very hazardous. Again, another belief is that nanoparticles are rather safe unless they're inhaled. So dermal exposures or ingestion may not pose as much of a risk. And also the other, I would say, myth that we encountered was that if you're dealing with known chemicals, that the exposures were not very threatening. Well, as you can tell from Dr. Ostrath and Ken Martinez's presentations, there is really nothing new about nanoparticles in terms of chemicals. These are not new chemicals. Nanosilver is still silver. Nanotitanium dioxide is still titanium dioxide. So the belief seemed to be that if it's a known chemical, whether it was nano or bulk did not really make a difference. And the other alarming, if you will, belief that emerged from our study was that standard precautions were effective. So wearing gloves or working in a regular hood, wearing a face mask, a regular surgical face mask, was enough to prevent occupational exposures. Interestingly enough, this also was a belief, even in research laboratories that had federal funding to look at the toxicology of nanoparticles. So on one hand, it's a very interesting dichotomy. On that one hand, you have researchers who have been paid to look at the toxicology of nanoparticles. Supposedly they're unknown because they got the research funding in the first place, yet on the other hand telling us, no, don't, we are not worried about the toxicity or the health hazards of nanoparticles because we're working in experimental doses. Just looking at time check. Implications for academia, our research really unveiled the need that we need to have some kind of an inventory. Again, as I've highlighted, unless research uses human subjects, animals, or some kind of a bioagent, there is no reliable way for the Department of Environmental Health and Safety or any other kind of oversight entity, a traditional oversight entity on a campus, to even find out what kind of research goes on in a research laboratory. You have these independent fiefdoms, you have these independent small businesses, if you will, that run on a large university campus, and the university doesn't really have a reliable way to find out what even goes on behind closed doors. And the other aspect that our colleagues on the Institutional Review Board particularly brought up was this issue, or the myth, if you will, of peer review. Because nanotechnology is still really in a phase where specialization is just beginning to happen, who is in a position to review my research hasn't really been settled. So because specialization hasn't really happened, if I'm working on a part of nanoparticle, who is my peer on campus to be able to review my research, to be able to review the occupational potential hazards of that research, and to advise IRB or IOCOC to say, yes, they should go ahead with this research or they should not go ahead with this research. So this whole idea of peer review hasn't really been settled on the university campus when it comes to nanotechnologies. I'm going to go through this real quick. In terms of exposure, not only do we not know on the campus who's being exposed to what, as an offshoot, we really have no reliable way of keeping track of exposures. We have a lot of students who are very similar to migrant workers. They're temporary workers, right? They're on campus maybe for 5 years at a time. Especially if they're dealing with material sciences, the kinds of nanoparticles that they deal with could be different from day to day, which makes it extremely difficult to do any kind of epidemiologic surveillance and to be able to, in the future, be able to trace back certain health conditions to their potential exposure during their graduate study. I'm going to wrap it up there. I'd be happy to take some questions at the end if you have any time, but